It was incredible the ways the girls applied their newly learned negotiation skills. The really heartening finding that I think we didn't expect is that the effects grew over time.
Welcome to Vox Dev Talks. My name is Tim Phillips. In Zambia, school fees increase at the end of middle school, and that might be bad news for many girls who drop out because their parents maybe don't want to pay the cost of their daughter's continuing education. But might training girls in the sort of negotiation skills that we would more commonly associate with lawyers or executives help keep them in school? And for the families involved, might this be what those executives would undoubtedly call a win-win? Kathleen McGinn of Harvard Business School is one of a team of researchers who've been teaching Zambia's 8th graders to negotiate, and she joins me today. Kathleen, welcome to Vox Dev Talks.
Thank you, Tim. It's great to be with you.
Tell me about this decision point that I mentioned in the intro. How old are the girls at this point? What choices do their parents make for them, and what's the consequence of that choice?
We worked with 8th grade girls. This is a critical point for girls because school fees increase and tests are required. So girls start dropping out after middle school. Girls are very likely to proceed into 9th grade because there's no big exam at this point. But to progress to 10th grade, girls have to take and pass a national exam, and parents have to pay reasonably substantial school fees. So enrollments in grades 10 and 11 capture whether girls passed that peak dropout point. So we trained the girls in 8th grade, and then we followed them for 3 years. Their parents don't exactly make choices for the girls. The assumption in testing the efficacy of these non-cognitive negotiation skills is that parents make choices with the girls, that decision-making within households happens sort of collectively within interactions. So if you think about Becker's seminal model on household decision-making, he posited that the household was monolithic, that it was like a single decision-maker. But more recent models offer more collective approaches in which decisions are the result of intra-household bargaining. Now, most of these models focus on the adult partners, the parents, but the underlying logic is that members of households bargain over investments in consumption. So if parents are making decisions independently for the girls, then girls' negotiation skills shouldn't have any effect on the allocation of resources to those girls. But if this collective inter-household bargaining model is right, and parents are making decisions with the girls, then endowing girls with negotiation skills could have sizable effects on the allocation of resources for the girls and the resulting schooling that the girls are able to achieve.
And culturally within Zambia, as I understand, respect for parents in the household is very important. So it is important that those negotiation skills are developed for the girls to be part of that collective decision making.
Absolutely. So our team spent years before starting the actual trial with focus groups and with the women we hired to teach the negotiation curriculum and then with pilot classes. And we were working to make the curriculum consistent with the cultural expectations for girls in Zambia. We learned and from the girls, and then we taught the girls how they could express their interests clearly and assertively, but in respectful and culturally acceptable ways. So, for example, we have this one exercise we call Why Mama? And the girls are put into a scenario where they want to go to their friend's house, but their mother said no. And so they have to practice over and over again asking questions about their mother's concerns to try to learn about why their mother won't let the girl visit her friend. And the teachers act out the mother's role, and the girls take turns in front of the class asking respectful questions of the mothers. And then as the girls learn their mother's interests for the girl's safety, for the need for her to look after her youngest child in the family, then the girls can start to come up with creative solutions that can meet their mother's interests and their own. But they can't just say, Mom, I want to do this.
Now, in the experiment that you did, what does developing these negotiation skills involve? What sort of course were the children on?
Well, It's built on, as you mentioned in the intro, the standard negotiation concepts and skills that are taught to MBAs and to lawyers and to executives. It's not so different from the classes I teach at Harvard Business School. It's based on foundational work by Fisher and Urey and others, and we incorporated some exercises from some programs. There's a program for young negotiators that works in high schools in the U.S., and there's Mercy Corps, which is an international program, has conflict resolution curriculum. And we, my co-authors Nava and Corinne and I, developed a curriculum that call Girls Arise, and it's got four basic components: me, you, together, build. And it's a very simple way of saying me, that is, what are your interests? You have to understand your own interests before you can effectively ask. You have to understand the other person's interests, you, so that you can start to see how there might be some mutual gain in the situation. Together is the interaction, trying to understand what can we give and take that can then help finally build a solution that's mutually agreeable. And ideally, as you said in the beginning, win-win, meaning we're both better off at the end than either of us could have been in any situation without the other. There's 6 afternoons of interactive training and debriefs led by the Zambian women I mentioned before. These are college grads with experience teaching. Coaches went through the training first themselves. We first taught the coaches, and they went through, I think, 6 weeks of training. And then they helped us revise the curriculum. And finally, they taught it to the girls in about 13 to 20 person sessions after school.
But here's something I don't quite understand, Kathleen. How does that translate into a mechanism by which the girls can stay in school for longer?
Yeah, it's a great question. So if you think about what allows the girls to stay in school, the most obvious one, of course, is resources, right? So there's these negotiations over resources, and I'll give you an example of that. But there's lots of other negotiations you can think about. Time to study. So these girls are asked to take lots of responsibility at home, like caring for their siblings, like cleaning, earning money. They also want to socialize with their friends. They also have intimate relationships. And so there are many negotiations with their friends, with their teachers, with their siblings, with their intimate partners. And each one of these negotiations allows them to have some control over their own time to study, for example. I'll give you an example we talk about in the paper that one of the girls shared with a coach. And she was talking about how happy she was that she had been able to get school fees. And she talked about the situation. She said, I put on my sort of traditional clothing and I knelt before them, which is a respectful position. And she talked about how she chose to approach them with respect. And then they said, you know, come talk to us. And she said she really wanted to go back to school, but she couldn't because the school fees weren't paid. And then she asked questions about why they weren't paid. And they talked about that they had no money, et cetera. So then she proposed a solution after listening to their interests and said, you know, mom sells chickens out of the house. But what about if I spent some afternoons and my school holidays selling chickens at the market where I could get more money? So we don't need additional chickens. We don't need additional time. Mom doesn't have to do anything. But I'll take these and I'll get more money at the market than mom can get selling them out of the house. And they agreed to that. And those monies went to her schooling. We heard multiple stories like this. The girls were asked to journal every evening. And then in the morning, they would come in and we would read their journals and discuss that in the sessions, in the afternoon sessions. And it was incredible the ways the girls applied their newly learned negotiation skills to interactions with their friends, with their parents, with their teachers, with their boyfriends.
Did you try other ways to help the girls, or what was the control group here?
So we had 2 other treatments and then a fully cross treatment. So the 2 other treatments were safe space. So this is an empowerment program that's been shown to be effective in lots of places in developing countries. And essentially what we did is we had exactly the same time and exactly the same materials. So the girls got a notebook, they got snacks after school, same 2 hours in the same locations as the negotiation treatments, which were basically in the schools. And they were run by the same coaches. So we thought exposure to these, the coaches were really quite amazing women. Exposure to these women could be a treatment all in its own. And so we had a safe space treatment, and that was one comparison. A third of the girls got negotiation, a third of the girls got safe space, and a third of the girls got no training and got training years later. All of those treatments were fully crossed with a pure information treatment that we gave at baseline and with information about the benefits of staying in school, about the payoffs to education, and about safe sex.
Now, what outcomes are you measuring here, Kathleen? What looks like success?
Yeah, so we got some promising hints even from the midline survey measures. So, for example, we saw in the midline survey that it looked like the girls in the negotiation treatment were getting more food, which we found encouraging. But our long-term outcomes were school outcomes. There were multiple outcomes. So we looked at enrollment, we looked at paid the fees, looked at took the exam, threshold scores on the exam, and then attendance rates. Some of these sort of feed into enrollment. So you have to take the exam and pay the fees in order to be enrolled. So we created aggregate measures of those. We also collected information on pregnancy. This was what we call in statistics a rare event. It's only about 4% of the girls, but it's really critical because pregnant girls aren't allowed to go to school. And so we also put that into a life index. And we basically, you don't want to do too many regression tests because you get problems with testing multiple times. So we created standardized scores average, and then we looked at average effect sizes across these outcomes.
And of course, the big question is, did negotiation work?
It did. negotiation relative to the control significantly increased enrollment and had significantly better standardized scores and average effect size. The really heartening finding that I think we didn't expect is that the effects grew over time rather than fading out.
Gosh.
Information had no effect whatsoever, and safe space didn't have significant effects on the outcomes measured on its own. When we do comparisons, we can't reject the possibility that safe space had similar effects on short-term human capital indices. It did not have the same effect on the long-term. The most critical long-term effect that only negotiation influenced was enrollment in the what was called morning school. Mm-hmm. And this is the school for students that have higher scores on the exam. So it's a higher ability school, but it also means that you get more contact hours with teachers. And as a result, those payoffs are lasting. And those are, I think that's the effect why that's why the negotiation training had such nice long-term effects.
Yes. Did some girls benefit more than others, though?
Yes. So this ties into the morning schooling. So high ability girls got the highest payoffs. So if we look at the cutoffs, sort of, we have ability scores based on composite indices, but think about this as sort of language skills. And if you look at the girls with the low language skills below about the 40th percentile, you don't see the same kind of effects. And if you think about the two components, so the first of all, we're training the girls in a school type setting, right? So there has to be some school aptitude to get the advantage of this. And second of all, our outcome measures are also about schooling. So it's reasonable that it's the high ability girls that get the highest payoff.
No, I think afterwards you used a survey and a game as well to dig deeper into what's changed here and why it has changed. What did you learn from that?
Yes, so this was Corinne Lowe's brainchild, she's one of my co-authors, and it's an incredible game. It's called a trust game. And basically what we did is we endowed the parents with one parent, and this was at midline. We endowed the parent with tokens. They were essentially phone tokens, which are sort of like cash in Zambia. And parents could keep their tokens or they could give them to the girls. And they had 10 tokens. If they gave them to the girls, the value doubled. And the girls' payoff was not in phone. It was in like school supplies or hair things, whatever they chose. It was sort of like this big table of things they could choose from. The mothers had to choose whether to give tokens to the girls or not. And the girls could choose whether to give tokens back. The critical thing that we learned is that if there's no communication between the girl and the parent during this trust game, negotiation training makes no difference.
Yeah.
It is not somehow that negotiation girls have sort of created a totally different relationship with their parents or with their friends or with their teachers. It's that they've learned how in critical times to use their communication, their negotiation skills learn about the other interests and get their own interests heard. So when we allowed communication, so there's one treatment that didn't allow it and one that did, when you allowed communication, then the negotiation girls got more tokens from their parents.
As you mentioned, these skills tend to develop over time. So can we make an argument that there are going to be additional benefits to girls, lifelong benefits to girls from learning these skills? Because that's quite interesting compared to the normal way to influence behavior like this, which might be sort of short-term incentives, for example.
Right. So we didn't compare directly to financial incentives, but we did look at the cost of our intervention and the benefit of the intervention in terms of the payoff for additional years. And when we compare this to studies where financial incentives or school uniforms were provided, it looks like negotiation training compares pretty favorably. So our cost for the intervention was about $60 a girl. And if you do this kind of translation, that looks like 0.16 additional years of schooling for every $100 of investment. And that is higher than almost all of the studies and essentially equal to a study by Duflo and colleagues in Ghana in terms of just pure cash incentives. So if you look at the additional schooling, just in terms of payoffs, it looks like the negotiation training has higher payoffs than financial incentives. But as you said, it's also worth noting that the returns to negotiation training accrued to the higher aptitude girls who are likely to realize higher returns from investments in schooling. And therefore, those investments are much more likely to accrue over time and grow over time, as opposed to be situated simply in the year when the schooling is paid for.
A valuable life skill, isn't it?
Absolutely.
Something that a lot of kids must be thinking, I wish I had that skill.
And a lot of adults.
Kathleen, thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Tim, and take care.
The paper we've been talking about is called Negotiating a Better Future: How Interpersonal Skills Facilitate Intergenerational Investment. And the authors are Narva Ashraf, Natalie Bao, Corinne Lowe, and Kathleen McGinn. And it was published in the Quarterly Journal of Economics, May 2020. This has been a Vox Dev Talk. If you enjoyed it, subscribe on your podcast platform and you will never miss an episode. Or you can find past episodes at voxdev.org.